Mark Ferguson is a jazz pianist, trombonist, composer, arranger, producer, and music educator. In this episode, you get to hear him perform three of his original compositions on piano. We talk about his mentors, perspectives on music education, and the interesting twists and turns in his varied career. He's performed with many of the world's great artists, including Ella Fitzgerald, Tony Bennett, Gil Evans, Aretha Franklin, Rob McConnell and the Boss Brass, Holly Cole, and Manteca. His website's linked in the description. All these episodes are available on all the podcast players, as well as video, and the transcripts are published to my blog. Everything's linked to my podcast website, leahroseman.com, in the description. I've included timestamps in the description for all the many topics that we cover. Good morning, Mark Ferguson. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Leah. Thank you for having me.
So you
looking forward to chatting with you.
Before we get into it, I'm sure you don't remember this, but I remember the very first time I met you. You know how we do so many wonderful concerts, and you often don't remember the great concerts, but the really bad ones you remember. So this was a wedding gig.
I'm glad I could be part of your bad gig.
Well, I think your part of the gig was great. That was what was so funny. So I think it's the last gig I did kind of like this soon after I joined the NAC Orchestra. So my husband Mark and I were playing violin duets in the hallway of the Chateau Laurier.
Don't tell me. I was just going to say Chateau Laurier. I do remember.
Really? And you were leading a big band, and I believe Kelly Lee Evans was singing with you.
Oh, is that right?
And you were
right?
holding your trombone. And Mark said, yeah, like he plays trombone and piano. He's really good. And you told me about Kelly Lee Evans, who I hadn't heard of before, who's a guest on this podcast. And you were having a great that time. You had a big ballroom, you know, with this big band. And we were in the hallway and we couldn't hear each other. And I love that people hire live music for their weddings. But these people...
Were we drowning you out?
Yeah.
Were we drowning you out? I apologize for that.
I believe you were in one room. And then in the other room, there was another band. And then they just had us for like visual effect as people walk through these two violinists. So,
well, those were the days when they had live music in every room in the Chateau Laurier. You know, it doesn't happen anymore.
Actually, in the 80s, there was an amazing jazz club there. I don't know if you were.
The Cock and Lion.
That's it. I used to go when I was a kid. Actually, my dad.
Yeah, I was living in Toronto at the time, but they would book the same acts at Bourbon Street on Queen Street West in Toronto, and then they would come to Ottawa. So yeah, I saw a few acts at the Cock and Lion too. It was great. It was when I moved to Toronto and I could see all my jazz heroes for the price of a plate of spaghetti. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was so great. Yeah.
So you grew up in Ottawa as well.
I did. I was born in Montreal and moved here when I was 5 and lived here until I was 20 and when I moved to Toronto.
Yeah. So you went to Humber College to study with one of your heroes?
Yeah, I did. Well, I went to Humber College because I'd heard it was the jazz school in Canada. And I didn't start studying with, I think the guy who was the biggest influence on me was Jerry Johnson.
Okay.
He was my trombonist. And I started studying with him in my second year there. But it was a fantastic place to meet musicians and just to play and learn. It was a great experience. That was late 70s.
Yeah.
You know, and then I was there in the early 80s too.
So when you started studying jazz trombone with him, had you... Like, I assume you started trombone in high school. Had you done much jazz with the trombone yet?
I tried. I was sort of, you know, doing it on my own. I wasn't, I was just learning from listening to records and doing what I could. But I hadn't really studied with a jazz player at that point. I really started on piano and studied with a really great piano teacher, Lila Flatt. That was a great name for a piano teacher, Mrs. Flatt. Mm-hmm. And she got me started, but at some point I got a fake book with lead sheets in it, and I showed her, I said, I'm really interested in learning to do this. And I said, like, what does the C major 7 mean? And she said, I have no idea. So at that point I started just kind of spending a lot of time at the piano by myself, learning by trial and error, and I really was kind of self-taught in that way with jazz, I think.
Mm-hmm. Were you still taking classical piano lessons at that point, or did you drop it?
Yeah, I stopped. I think I got to grade 8 conservatory. I stopped when I was about 17, I guess. But I had a lot of really diverse influences in Ottawa. There's of course the school band, and then I joined the Ottawa Youth Orchestra, and I also joined rock bands. And in those days, horn bands were a big deal. Chicago, mm-hmm. Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Lighthouse, and so I played all the funky little bars over in Hull when I was about 15, 16, underage. But the Ottawa House, the Standish Hall, Chaudière Club, all these places are all gone now. Mm-hmm. But so there, it was, I really had a kind of a diverse kind of musical experience, and that's, I've always loved a lot of different types of music. So it was a great training ground for me.
Were you playing trombone on all those gigs, or sometimes keyboard?
I was playing mostly trombone at that point, and when I moved to Toronto, I didn't tell anybody I played piano because I just wanted to concentrate on trombone. And in those days, there was quite a thriving studio scene in Toronto. So that was my idea, that I was going to move to Toronto and become a studio musician. And I did do a lot of recording gigs, but early 80s, they came out with the DX7 and digital synthesis, and guys started creating jingles in their bedrooms, so it just put a lot of musicians out of work at that point. I was just playing trombone in Toronto at the beginning.
Now, you just mentioned jingles. I was going to ask you about that later, because you're a composer, and I know you've written some jingles as well as music for
software. Yeah, I've written a few, not many, yeah. But I've written a few jingles, but I played on a lot when I was in Toronto. You just get called and go in at 9 o'clock in the morning, and you're out of there by 9:45 usually.
Yeah.
Usually the rhythm section had already been in, and the singers, and then they were just adding the horns afterwards.
How was your family's, were they supportive of you playing in these bars when you were so young? How did that work out?
Surprisingly, I wouldn't be that lenient with my kids. But I'm not sure my mom really knew what I was getting into. She just knew I loved music, yeah. And they were very supportive. And she and my dad did come to the Chaudière Club in Hull Elmer, I guess, to hear me, so they were very supportive. And they would come out to the youth orchestra concerts, and they were extremely supportive. But I'm not sure she realized exactly how bad it was over there. Like drug dealers at the door and motorcycle gangs. It was wild.
Yeah,
but when you're that age, you don't really think about it. Just, hey, I'm playing music for a living. They're paying me to play music. It was so great.
How much did you get paid for those kind of gigs?
I was afraid you'd ask me that. No, I have no memory of what I got paid, but I'm sure it was peanuts.
Yeah.
But it was a great experience.
So you mentioned your trombone teacher in Humber. What were lessons with him like?
Well, one thing I loved about Jerry Johnson. I first saw Jerry Johnson with Maynard Ferguson's band at the National Arts Center, I guess, when I was a teenager. And so he was kind of an idol. And then when he came to teach at Humber, that was fantastic. And the one thing I remember about his teaching style that really worked for me was that he would play at the lessons all the time. And so, it was just, I wanted to sound like him. So, It was great to have that experience of having somebody who could, like a really virtuosic player standing beside you and that's what the trombone's supposed to sound like. It was great in that way. And he was also in the house band at the Royal York Hotel. And the Royal York Hotel in Toronto is one of the big CN hotels that they built on the railway, like the Chateau Laurier in Ottawa. And they had a room called the Imperial Room, which was beautiful, beautiful dining room. And they would book acts like Ella Fitzgerald, Tony Bennett, Rosemary Clooney, Rita Moreno. So I got to, Jerry would hire me to play with the band when they needed another trombone player. And So that was a fantastic experience. I got to play with all these people, and really thanks to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you, because those names come up when you look up Mark Ferguson. It's funny, Maynard Ferguson comes up too when you Google your name.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my goodness, no relation.
Well, because you type, you know, Mark Ferguson Jazz, and then you know there's a guy in Australia. You know about this man?
Yes, I do.
It's
yeah,
funny.
I saw that. He's is he a talk show host?
No, he's a jazz pianist who teaches at a university and also composes and arranges.
Does he play trombone?
I don't think he plays trombone, but he uses his middle name, Mark Simeon Ferguson, I believe.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's funny. There used to be a Mark Ferguson in Toronto who was a dancer, and we used to get each other's checks occasionally. He eventually changed his name to Mark Cassius, but I met him years later on a gig somewhere. So, yeah, I guess Ferguson is a fairly common name.
Well, it was just funny in the music
and,
world.
And as as you know, Mark is a very common name, too. You're married to one.
So I was going to ask you, Rob McConnell, like, because you studied arranging with him, right, in terms of your heroes in Toronto.
Yeah, he was the other big hero for me. And I met him when I was 19. I went out to a jazz clinic, a week-long jazz workshop in Fredericton with Phil Nimmons. And the staff, were Rob McConnell, Mo Kaufman, Guido Basso, and Phil Nimmons' group. So there were only two trombonists there, myself and another guy. And so I was really like I had Rob to myself for a week. And then I ended up driving back to Ontario with him, really getting to know him well. And he hired me occasionally for a few things in Toronto. Not often, but so I got to play with the Boss Brass a few times. And I did get a Canada Council grant to study arranging with Rob, which was fantastic.
Yeah.
It's great. I would go down to his place and spend the weekend. You know, he'd make me dinner and we'd get up the next morning and listen. Mostly we listen to music. It's amazing.
And do you teach arranging, some of the things you learned from him in the way of teaching? Do you use those techniques?
Absolutely. Yes, I do. I actually play my, because I teach arranging at Carleton University, and I play a lot of Rob McConnell's arrangements for my students, and we analyze them. And so yes, he was a huge influence.
Mm.
And also a great, fantastic trombone player too, valve trombone.
But he didn't play slide trombone, right? He played valve
That's
trombone?
Right, valve trombone. Yeah, he said he played slide trombone when he was a young guy, but at some point switched over to valve, and it really was his voice, you know. It was really his sound. It really worked for him.
But is it as expressive? Like, you don't have the between the notes.
Well, you can't play glissando.
Yeah.
But you have a lot more flexibility, really, because of the valves rather than having to work the slide. And I've tried it, but it's a very different animal because. You know, as trombonists, we get used to articulating notes as we move the slide. Mm-hmm. And so having a valve combination and trying to articulate is, it's very different. It's hard to describe, but I tried it and I just went back to slide.
Yeah.
Because it didn't feel right.
In terms of like...
They're also, it's hard to find instruments that are really in tune.
Okay.
Valve trombones, surprisingly. I don't know why that is.
Hmm. And do they bend notes with their embouchure, like for blues playing?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you can bend notes, you can flatten or sharpen a note with your embouchure.
Mm-hmm.
And of course on the slide trombone you can use your slide.
Yeah.
And there's never any excuse. Well, it's like playing a string instrument. There's never any excuse for playing out of tune because you should be able to find the pitch there somewhere.
Yeah. So you're sitting at your other main instrument, piano.
Yes. Yes.
Do you want to take a music break? Would you be willing to play for us?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
So what are you going to play?
Well, I'll play one of my own compositions. This is a tune that I called F sharp, very unimaginative title. The reason I called it F sharp is because I wanted to take one note as a pedal point and just see how I could work harmonies around that one note. And so it happens to be a F sharp. So I'm going to turn my vocal mic off so that it doesn't pick it up. And let me know if the sound is okay. So I'm cheating a little bit. I've got a chart in front of me because it's been a little while since I played this tune. So I did write it, but I'm going to read. Thank you.
Wow, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Leah. One last F sharp at the end.
So when you said you were reading the chart, it's a lead sheet with what seems to be a very fancy chord progression.
Yeah, it's just really, I don't know if you can see this, but it's really
that's
hard to read, isn't it? It's kind of a skeleton. It's just a melody with chord symbols written above it.
Yeah.
And so it gives the performer a lot of chance to interpret it however I want to. And so it's never going to come out exactly the same, you know, two times in a row. It'll always be a little bit different. And there's a big section for improvisation in the middle there, I think you heard.
Yeah, it's such a cool idea to have that ostinato, that repeating F sharp. And I was thinking, you know, jazz harmony, there's so many, the chords get so dense. It's all, you know, you get practically all the notes.
Yeah, there's you know, there are just so many possibilities. And something that I really like in music is when the harmony gets very, very dense, and then suddenly there's like a triad. Mm-hmm. And it feels so fresh, and somehow just a very simple triad can sound really like a revelation, you know, like the sun coming out, like mm-hmm. so fresh.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me because it's like you have a split personality of the horn player and then the keyboard player, like, you know, because you're a rhythm player and all this, you know, harmonic complication, and then just playing a horn line is different function.
Yeah, I think it's good to have the two because I've always found it gives me an insight into, if I'm playing with the rhythm section, I know what the piano player is thinking and how he's feeling, and I'm trying to communicate with the other musicians. So I think having the job of playing as a soloist, I guess, or a frontline player, and the job of having being in a rhythm section, it's good to have both perspectives so that I think it makes communication with the other musicians easier.
Yeah. And you had a bit of a Latin groove going on in that tune as well.
A little bit, yeah. It certainly wasn't a swing tune. It was very much a straight eighth kind of feel.
Yeah. Do you still have your Latin band, Los Gringos? Or?
You know, we've sort of put that on the back mm-hmm. burner. I think the last time we played was probably before the pandemic. But I am playing with a great Cuban pianist, Miguel Darmes, who's living in Ottawa now, and he is from Havana originally, and it's his compositions and arrangements are just beautiful. It's the real thing, you know. It's Cuban music.
Are you playing trombone and with him?
Yes, okay. That's right. Yeah, and I also play with a band called Manteca,
right?
Which is a Toronto band, and a band that I, you know, they've been together since the late 70s, and I was a big fan. I owned their albums and used to go and hear them whenever I could, and I joined the band in 2006, I believe.
Yeah.
So I've been with them for, yeah, a decade and a half now.
I was going to say congratulations on the relatively new album, 2020. I bought it. I've been listening to it.
Oh, great. That's good. Yeah, we recorded, four or five albums since I joined the band.
Yeah.
And we have something nice we're playing a couple of jazz festivals in Markham and Prince Edward mm-hmm. County in August. And then in October, we're going back into the studio. And rather than recording an album, we're doing three short sort of TV shows or podcasts. I don't know what to call them anymore. But with special guests, in the past they've been, you know, Canadian artists. Mm-hmm. And I believe this time we're going to be playing with some of the offspring
okay.
of the members of Manteca, because a lot of them have really gone on to, you know, do some great things, the next generation.
Yeah, that's really cool. So yeah, it's the 12th of Never is the album I was referring to.
Right. I guess that is the most recent one.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it lists you as playing piano, trombone, bass trombone, and I think vibes, unless that was another album.
Yeah. No, that's right. I play some vibraphones. I don't have any technique on the vibraphone, but I'm able to add colors, okay. You know, and it's a nice color. There are a lot of different colors in Manteca because Colleen Allen, who's the reed player, plays everything, you know, piccolo, flute, alto flute, alto saxophone, tenor saxophone, bass clarinet, and accordion. There are just a lot of colors in the band, and vibraphone is one that adds a nice kind of texture.
And there's a lot of hand percussion too, as opposed to drum sets.
Yes, yes. There's a drummer and a conga player who also plays all kinds of toys, different percussion instruments. And Matt Zimbel, who is the leader, plays congas and some other Latin percussion.
Yeah. Things. So that must have been really cool that you had been listening to their albums and you were able to join the band.
Yeah, I was surprised to get the call. I was living in Elmer at the mm-hmm. time, and Matt called and asked if I wanted to join the band. I said, yes, of course. So, it's been a really nice experience.
I was curious if they're still based in Toronto, because on Bandcamp it says Montreal. Is there?
Matt lives in Montreal. Mm-hmm. Everyone else lives in Toronto. I live in Ottawa, but most of the band are in Toronto. So that's where we rehearse, mm-hmm. and most of our gigs are around the Toronto area.
And you're still listed that you teach at McGill part-time?
Yeah, you know, I haven't taught there since before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I'm still on their roster, but at this point, I used to take the train down every Monday morning and you know, teach four students, okay. then come home on the train. And it just, with COVID and everything, I just didn't want to be doing that.
Yeah.
So I don't know what, I don't know whether I will be teaching there in the future. It's hard to say.
I was just curious how you managed all this commuting, because you do so many things.
Yeah, it was actually a good commute, because I was on the train at, I lived near the train station. I was on the train at 6 o'clock and home by 5:30, so it was like putting in a full work day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just a good experience, you know, to get out of the city and to be around other musicians and meet students from, well, at McGill, you know, they're from all over the country. So that was a nice experience.
Yeah. I went to McGill for my undergrad, and I did mm-hmm. take a great jazz history course, which was not required.
Yes. Oh, with Andre White?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
Fred.
Great, yeah. Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed it very much. It was one of my most memorable courses, for sure. But I was thinking about how siloed classical world is, and it's really unfortunate.
It is. You know, that's interesting you mentioned that, because I'm playing at Music and Beyond tomorrow night with a colleague from Carleton, James McGowan, mm-hmm. who has written, I guess you'd call it a suite, several pieces for string quartet, rhythm section, jazz rhythm section, and four horns. Four horns, that's right. Ed Lister, Pete Cancura, Mike Tremblay, and myself. And he's playing piano. And it's very much a fusion of classical and jazz and gospel, and I'd say there are some funk or rock elements in there too. So you do hear occasionally a successful fusion of the two musics. And I know you just worked with Esperanza Spalding, am I correct?
Oh yeah, we did. But I don't mean that we don't play stuff together. What I mean mm-hmm. is in our education.
Ah, I see. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, when I did my degree at Ottawa U, and it was exclusively classical, and then I went to Humber. Humber, actually, we had to combine the two. Mm-hmm. I took a music history course, and I played a lot of, you know, the Bach cello suites and all kinds of classical mm-hmm. music. So they certainly weren't snobbish about, you know, like, all you're going to do is jazz. So I love that. I don't like those kind of barriers between different types of music. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan. And I think it's, you know, it's not the same as it was like 20 or 30 years ago. I don't think education is as siloed mm-hmm. as you put it. Seems like there's more of a mixture now.
I'm glad to hear that. I don't know. Like, you would mm-hmm. know better than me about that.
Well, certainly at Carleton, it's a pretty broad kind of department. There's a singer-songwriter program mm-hmm. and jazz. There's even a Celtic studies program. So they're really, you know, mixing everything together. It's a real kind of melting pot.
Yeah.
Mosaic? Melting pot, I guess. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Megan Jerome...
Megan was a student at Carleton.
Yeah, she mentioned how great a jazz theory teacher you were. And another guest, Kelly Lee Evans, also mentioned, you know.
Yes, Kelly Lee was coming to my classes for a few years there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, she doesn't need it. She's got this amazing career and she's so good at what she does. But I thought it was really great that she wanted to learn more about the music, you know, get deeper into it.
Well, I think someone like her, she's so incredibly intuitive and just learns by osmosis, but she hadn't learned to read music until very late in her career.
Well, that makes me think of somebody I worked with back in the 80s, Ella Fitzgerald. She didn't read music at all and learned everything by ear and, you know, was perfect. Incredible. Yeah.
I was wondering in terms of, your teaching, we talked a little bit about orchestration and having students listen, and I was hearing at Carleton the way the theory is taught is quite oral as well, which is so different than the way I learned theory, which was so dry and all written and,
I mean, you know, there is that. I don't teach the first year theory courses, mm-hmm. so most of the dry stuff, you know, just learning the basics, hopefully is already taken care of. So I make sure that theory is not just taught in a vacuum. We listen to a lot of music. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things, actually. It's kind of the opposite of what we're talking about, but coming up in the conservatory system playing piano, I would just learn pieces and, you know, the beautiful, great selections. You know, the way the conservatory book was set up with Baroque and Renaissance, mm-hmm. and then the middle was Romantic, and then the last part was 20th century. But there was never any discussion of what the harmonies were or why they worked the way they did, why this chord leads to the next chord. So I would have loved to have had more of that kind of theoretical knowledge back then that just would make more sense of the music to me. It was beautiful music to play, but you're kind of doing it by rote, you know, you're learning the notes but not really learning why the composers chose those notes.
Mm-hmm. One thing that always amazes me about jazz players who do a lot of gigs like yourself is how you have such a library of tunes in your head with all those progressions.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was really fortunate to work with, over 20 years, I guess, with a great saxophone player named Huey O'Connor, who died in his 90s just a few years ago. We always had a gig somewhere. We played at Clair de Lune in the Market for many years, and we always had a Friday or Saturday or Sunday gig. And we never used any, he didn't bring out charts, you know, there was no music. So he'd say, you know, do you know this tune? Do you know Body and Soul? And I'd say, yeah, I think so. And if I didn't know a tune, I'd go away, and next week when I came back, I would have learned it. But just, you know, when you play with music in front of you all the time, it's a crutch. You don't ever get away from the music. If you want to learn to play without music, you got to take the sheet music away. So that was great for me to learn tunes. And he was very patient. You know, I would play horribly sometimes and screw up, but he would play on his horn what the chords were, you know, outlining the chords, and he knew all the hip chords, all the great, you know, the really good sounding harmonizations. So I was really fortunate to play with him for years, and that's where I learned a lot of the repertoire.
Okay. And this might sound silly, but even the name of the tune, I don't know how you sort that out. Is it like automatically once you know the tune, you know the name?
You know, I'm really bad with remembering titles of tunes. I'm really good with, I always remember the key that it's in. But, you know, I'll be on the bandstand sometimes and say, let's play, you know, the tune in F, you know, the...
That goes like
you
this.
Know, that tune in F, yeah, it goes like this. Right. So, I think learning the titles of the tunes, something that I think is really important, and a lot of jazz musicians feel this way, is learning the lyric to a tune. Hmm. Because it gives you another frame of reference. You don't get lost in the tune if you're thinking of a lyric in your head. Hmm. In fact, there's a famous story about, I think it was Ben Webster, who was a great tenor saxophone player who played with Duke Ellington and all kinds of people. And he was at a jam session. He was playing a tune, and he just stopped playing at some point. And someone asked him afterwards, why'd you stop playing? And he said, I forgot the words. You know, so that's a really good kind of indication of how important the lyric can be. And also, you want... If you're playing My Funny Valentine, for instance, it's kind of, the lyrics are very self-deprecating and kind of sad in a way. And if you're playing it, it just has nothing to do with the original concept of the tune. So I think that's another important reason to learn the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And I always try to get my students to learn the lyrics. Not always successfully, but I try.
So do you sing when you're learning a new tune?
Not really, but I listen to a lot of recordings of you know, if I want to learn a tune, I'll go on, because everything's available on YouTube now, it's great. Mm-hmm. I'll go to like a version by Frank Sinatra, because usually he'll sing it pretty straight. Or, I won't listen to Billie Holiday so much, because she changes all the melody notes. Mm-hmm. So I try to listen to several versions, but I start with somebody who I know is going to sing the melody pretty much the way it was written. And then, of course, learning, being able to play a tune in different keys is really important too. I've worked with a lot of singers, and singers are famous for doing tunes in not the standard keys. So that's been a great experience, having to learn, you know, Autumn Leaves. Or whatever key it is in. You get to know the function of the chord rather than the chord itself, and that means you can play it in any key.
That was going to be my next question. Was okay. About transposition and working with singers, so.
Yes. it's an unfortunate fact that most of the tunes that young jazz musicians learn from the fake books were written by males, because they're songs from the, you know, 30s and 40s, not exclusively, but a lot of them were. And so they're generally about a fourth or a fifth away from the standard female voice. Mm-hmm. So most people will learn, Misty. So most people learn it in E flat. But you get on a gig and the singer's going to say, let's do Misty in A flat or A or something. So knowing that the first chord is the one chord, it's the one chord. So if I'm in A flat, I know it's the one chord. So I'm not thinking it's an E flat chord. I'm thinking it's a one chord.
Yeah.
And so it takes a lot of practice to get good at that, but it's just a matter of doing it a lot, playing tunes in different keys.
Is it easier as a keyboard player than like as a horn player, but then you have more notes to play?
I think it is. I think it is because the piano is a visual instrument, mm-hmm. and you can see what you're doing, and you've got the whole orchestra in front of you, really. If you're playing one note at a time, I think it can be tougher. That's why whenever I teach, because sometimes I teach, someone will come to me who's a singer or a saxophone player or whatever, a bass player, and I always get them to play some piano. It's really important that I think that every musician plays piano. They don't have to be great pianists, but just to have some keyboard technique. Mm-hmm. not even technique, keyboard harmony knowledge, really.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious about voicing, because for someone like me who's like super basic pianist, yeah, I can like plunk down the chords, but I can't begin to think about how to, you know.
Right.
Could you maybe give us a...
Sure, go ahead.
Well, maybe just give us an example of like a standard tune and like show us different ways you can voice it, so it'd be like...
Sure. Well, I was talking about Misty. Why don't we look at that? So, the standard, most people, when they learn chords, they learn them in root position.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, root position chords are probably the worst sounding chords you can have. So, the first chord in Misty is an E flat major 7. So, that's root position. But if I leave out the fifth and the root in my right hand and just make a really simple sounding voicing, so I've got the root in my left hand and the third and the seventh in my right hand, it's much clearer, more transparent than... So there's, yeah, voicings, that's a huge area of study. And, you know, listening to the great ones like Bill Evans, Oscar Peterson, people like that, you know, they've just put so much thought into voicings. And it's not always just about playing the chord, it's about the inner moving voices. So it can be as much about counterpoint as about just harmony.
And you do a lot of arranging. So is that a large part of what you're doing? And are you doing it at the piano?
A lot of my arranging now I do at the computer, but I was an arranger pre-computer, so I'm glad that I had to do it on staff paper without being able to hear it played back by the computer program. I do still arrange at the piano, but I guess you get to a certain point where you know some voicings are going to work and some aren't. So and then sometimes it'll surprise you. You'll write something that you don't think is going to work and it sounds great. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll write something, I'll voice everything out in very lush voicings, dense harmonies, and then go back and realize that if I just had everybody playing in unison, it would have sounded way better. So sometimes, you know, you'll put a lot of work in and realize, didn't have to do all that work.
Yeah. So I'm curious how you balance, how do you stay in shape as a trombone player? It takes a lot of work just to...
Yeah, I have to play every day. And it's, well, you talk to any brass player and you'll know that maintenance is a really important thing. Long tones, flexibilities, tonguing exercises. Just to keep this in shape, keep the embouchure in shape. Mm-hmm. So, it was interesting during the pandemic because for the first time in my life, I didn't pick up the trombone for about over a month. Mm-hmm. And I'd never done that before. So I had to kind of get my chops back afterwards. But there just weren't any gigs, you know, and everybody was on pause for a little while there.
Did you still practice piano or still play?
I still played piano, sure. And you know, during the pandemic, I did a lot online. People would either send me tracks and they'd ask me to play on the tracks or through syncspace.live, which was a great platform for doing concerts online.
Yeah, I've heard you so many concerts on syncspace. And in my interview with Diane Nalini, of course, we talked about how that got going.
Yeah. Yeah, she and her husband, Adrian, have been absolutely fantastic. It's just really, it was really a boost to all of us musicians just to have a place to play and to keep our spirits up and to be able to express ourselves. It was really have to thank them for that.
Were you teaching online a little bit, like through the university?
Yeah, I taught. I didn't enjoy it, but I taught two courses from each semester. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of work. Just getting the technology together was a lot of work. And I didn't enjoy, I just didn't get to know my students.
Yeah.
Basically I was recording classes and they could watch them whenever they wanted. So I never really got to know my students, and I didn't enjoy that part of it. And then this past year we were back in the classroom masked, but at least we were in the classroom together.
Yeah.
So that was better.
Do you see changes in our industry going forward as a result of this pandemic that will stay?
I think that some of the online platforms are going to stay and probably get better. Mm-hmm. You're doing these podcasts, and I would imagine that was started during the pandemic.
Definitely, right? Yeah.
I think it's one of the great things about being able to play online is I was doing a lot of concerts with musicians I never met before who live in Toronto or Montreal or even New York, you know. So I think it'll, you know, it makes the world a smaller place. You can play with people who aren't in the same vicinity as you are. I can see it being a real boost for that. But still, you know, there's nothing like playing together in the same room with people.
And the audience right there and reacting.
An audience, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit about voicing, and also like in terms of being a rhythm section. And I was listening. I'd love for you to play again. I was just listening very carefully to the way you varied. You know, you had this ostinato, but still the rhythmic feel kept changing, because that's the brilliance of a great rhythm player, is that it's not all the same.
Right. I'm sorry, is there a question in there?
There's going to be a question, yeah. At this point, I imagine it's not a conscious process, but maybe at the beginning it was, that you'd think, oh, I better mix it up, or learning from great rhythm players.
That's an interesting question, because, you know, you really, as a jazz musician, you have to learn the language of bebop, you know, the language of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, and and then kind of not forget it, but internalize it, and not have to think about it a lot as you're playing. And of course, with any type of music, time is so important. Rhythm is the most important thing. So that's why I think it's important to play with others. I've heard some good players who didn't have good time because they played by themselves mostly. So I think that's really important to, I really think that rhythm is the most important component of music, beyond harmony or anything. And it doesn't matter what kind of music you're playing. It's the most important thing. So, I've always practiced with a metronome to get that kind of strict metronomic time together. Of course, you don't want to do that when you're playing for real. But that's how I, you know, that was one of the ways I worked on my time. Some people don't believe in using metronomes. But I just think it's so important to trust other people's time when you're playing with them.
Mm-hmm. But I mean the feel, like just the type of groove you're giving the music and the way it gets changed up. So it's, that's what I'm talking about.
Oh, I see. Groove. Well, again, I think that's something that you learn from listening to a lot of music, I don't know. I'm having trouble answering that question.
Okay.
I think it is a real matter of listening and getting to know the music. For example, playing with Miguel's Cuban band, for a lot of us Canadian musicians, it's really like we're like fish out of water, because we're trying to get these rhythms that we just didn't grow up with. And the Cuban guys in the rhythm section are playing amazing things. Sometimes it's hard to figure out where one is, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it really has a lot to do with listening. That's what I would say.
Okay. So osmosis as well as like conscious focus
listening. Yeah, you have to immerse yourself in the music, that's for sure.
Yeah. I think a big loss in this pandemic for young musicians has been the lack of being able to play together. You know, bands were canceled. And
right. Absolutely. Yeah, I felt so sorry for a lot of the high school musicians who finally had a chance to play with the band, and there was nothing for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
I forgot what it was. Going to go somewhere else, and I've forgotten where I was going.
Well, I was going to ask you about doing high school clinics, because I know it's something you've done in your career, and I was kind of curious the kind of things you work on, because these kids are a pretty basic level usually.
Yeah, and you know, they're usually really pretty curious, and they know they want a piece of what we're doing, but they don't know how to get there. So again, I just really recommend, I talk about listening to, you know, like, do you know who Louis Armstrong is? Do you know who Duke Ellington is? Do you know who Count Basie is? Do you know who Charlie Parker is? Miles Davis? And just trying to make them aware of, because we're not exposed to any of that type of music on the radio, or you have to seek it out. So that's why at the clinics, I really talk a lot about the history of the music, and we get to the nuts and bolts of chords and scales and all that stuff, but really trying to get them to hear music that I think that, you know, a lot of them are really going to, it's not going to connect with everybody, but a lot of them are really going to get turned on by something they haven't heard before. And if I can expose them to something like that, that's, I feel like it's as a young musician, that's what I appreciated, was having an older musician ask me if I'd heard so-and-so. Mm-hmm. And then kind of, usually it would, you know, I'd move back because, so I've heard Miles Davis, who came before Miles? Oh, Dizzy Gillespie. Who came before Dizzy Gillespie? Roy Eldridge. Who came before Louis Armstrong? So working your way through the history of the music is a great thing. So that's what I try to do at clinics, make the students aware of the history and the tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you play another tune for us? Would you be willing
to? I'd love to. Yes. I'm going to play a tune that I wrote, I guess about 10 years ago now. And I'd been on the road in California for about 3 weeks. And I came home and was with my family and around all my stuff and my piano. And everyone, my wife had gone to work, the kids had gone to school. And I sat down at the piano, and the piece just kind of wrote itself. And it was a really, it was kind of a celebration of being at home again. And so I called it Home. I've since learned that there are about a million songs out there called Home. But this is my version of Home. And I've recorded this a couple of times. I recorded it on an album, a duo album with Mike Tremblay. And then again, I did it with my trio with John Gagey and Scott Latham. So this is Home. I'm going to turn the vocal mic off. Thank you.
Gorgeous. Thanks so much. What a great tune.
Thank you, Leah. Big C major triad at the end.
Yeah, some definitely some gospel sonorities in there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it just really, it kind of, I hope it, you know, it expresses the kind of exuberance I felt at being home after being away for a long time.
Yeah, I think it expresses a peaceful kind of.
Yeah. Good.
I was trying to think who it was. I think it was Kelly Lee Evans was saying she learned that you shouldn't tell an audience too much about a tune before you present it because it'll bias them.
True. And at the same time, it's sometimes it's nice to set up something so that people have kind of an image in their mind. So I guess I'm saying the opposite of what Kelly Lee was saying.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, when Kelly Lee does a tune, she has the advantage of having a lyric, too. So I think when you're playing instrumental music, I know people love it when you talk to them at a concert. And I notice, you know, in the NACO now, that Alexander Shelley's very good at that, setting up a piece of music so that people have some frame of reference when they listen to an instrumental piece of music, and it gives you something to think about when you're listening to it.
Yeah, I really like that, and certainly when I play chamber music concerts, I really it's helped me with my nerves, although it's a different kind of nerves to talk to people, but you feel more connected with them.
Absolutely, yes. The audience certainly appreciates it.
And actually, speaking of nerves, so you're one of these people that doesn't really get nervous performing for people, but when you were younger and you were learning the ropes, it must have been a different, like learning to improvise in public.
Yeah, that's pretty scary. But, you know, to be honest, I was just so in love with it and so kind of, you know, driven, like one, I was on one track, you know, and I just... I didn't really think about it all that much, I don't think. I was just like really having fun and trying to learn and get better. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm still doing, trying to learn and get better.
Yeah. Do you have any upcoming projects or like, are you writing new tunes for a new album?
I'm thinking about recording a bunch of solo piano pieces that I've written over quite a few years. And they're all kind of representative of members of my family, my immediate family and my extended family. And they're not necessarily jazz pieces. I wouldn't know how to describe them, but I'm thinking about doing that as a project over the next little while. And other than that, it's mostly, you know, working with the bands that I play with, Manteca and Miguel Darmas and, there's also a really great band that I write for sometimes, Ed Lister's Prime Rib Band. Yeah, it's a big band in Ottawa. It's really a neat project.
I just remembered it was not Kelly Lee Evans that said that. It was Diane Nalini, because she was saying there's certain songs she sings that have a completely different meaning than people ascribe to them.
Interesting.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about the whole big band thing, because a lot of the playing you've done and is like, this totally different sound to this intimate, you know, solo piano or small ensemble that I've mostly heard you play. Do you feel like there's different parts of your personality that come out?
That's a very good question. I don't think I'd be the best judge. I think, you know, an audience member would be the best judge. I think that I probably have a different voice on the piano than I do on the trombone. Mm-hmm. I find the playing a wind instrument is a much more physical thing, and so I know I'm a fairly gentle piano player. I have a fairly soft touch. I don't bang on the piano at all. So I would think that I'm probably more aggressive when I'm playing a wind instrument than I'm on the piano. Maybe that seems like an obvious thing that you would be. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, it's also just the sound. You know, these bands are like, it's such a different.
Yes.
Art form, really.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I don't do a lot of big band playing anymore. When I was in Toronto, I played in a lot of big bands. I guess there were just, you know, more musicians doing that back then.
Yeah.
But I really, you know, we play once a month at a club on Bank Street, and it's like a party every time.
You know, I'm curious about the how like the, not the demographics, but how popular jazz is, because I've always thought of it as very niche. But what's interesting, when I was looking on YouTube for like, I was literally looking for YouTubes about jazz harmony because I was curious to learn some more.
Right, yeah.
These videos are getting like, you know, 500,000 hits. Like, who are these people?
I know. Well, the world's a big place and they've got the whole world as their audience. Now, yeah, it is a niche music, absolutely. I know I'm always checking out YouTube. I'm basically getting free lessons on YouTube all the time. There's so many people doing really good things on jazz education, really, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of rock and pop players might be interested in learning more in that direction, even if they're not jazzers.
I think so. I think you're right.
Yeah, and I've noticed with orchestral music, actually our music director now, Alexander Shelley, he's actually a jazz pianist. I don't know if you know that about him.
I knew that we did a gig one time a few years ago where... oh my goodness, I'm going to forget the name of the singer. There was a female Canadian jazz singer on the bill. I've forgotten her name now. And he played piano with her. And sounded good.
He'll be looking at the score and he'll just call out the name of the chord, which is clearly a jazz chord. And I think it's
right.
It's very... very easy for him to memorize very difficult scores, which really impresses me. I'm wondering if that training might have helped him.
Yeah, I'm sure it did, because I think it's a way of, I mean, the whole jazz chord system is a way of codifying, harmonies. It's like when I'm thinking of, I heard you guys play the Rite of Spring a month ago. And what is it? That's an E flat 7 over E.
Yeah.
But I'm sure Stravinsky didn't think of it as that, you know. But jazz harmony gives you a way of identifying a chord. And it's not always accurate, but at least gives you an idea of it. So I can see that having training in jazz piano, you'd be able to look at the score and figure out what you could call that chord, basically. Mm-hmm. And, it's not always totally accurate, but it's a way to codify it.
You said you were mainly self-taught with jazz piano, but did you study jazz piano with someone at a certain point?
That's funny. I had to think about that. No, I never did.
Wow.
It was always, like I said, when I moved to Toronto, I didn't tell anybody I played piano for the first several years because I just wanted to concentrate on the trombone. But at some point, people started asking me to do gigs, and then I kind of a dark period where I did a couple of years in lounges, doing lounges, which it was with singers, and it was a good education, but it was mostly playing top 40 stuff in lounges, so that was a way to make a living and. In one respect, it wasn't a great path because I was always busy 6 nights a week, and somebody called me for a great jazz gig, and I couldn't do it. So, I'm not sure about whether that was a good move or not. But it's all part of the learning process.
Yeah. So when you got out of that gig, was it like, did you just quit cold turkey, or were you able to kind of phase out of that?
Oh, I actually. I quit pretty much cold turkey because I decided I wanted to. I came back to Ottawa and finished my degree. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get a little more education, and that sort of sent me on a different path.
Yeah.
So also those kind of in Toronto at that point there were lounges, so many venues to play. I could play 6 nights a week with different singers all the time. There just isn't that anymore.
Yeah.
So in a way, I feel for the young musicians because there aren't venues for them to play. I could go out even when I was in my teens, every weekend I could go out and play and make a few bucks. But there just really isn't that anymore.
So what kind of advice are you giving young players, career-wise?
I try not to give them advice career-wise because I don't want to be a downer. And so I try to concentrate on the art of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think many of us get into music because we want to get rich, you know. So there are a lot of other more stable avenues to go than music if you want to do that. So I try to concentrate on the music, and I think that's why people get into music because they just can't help themselves, you know. They really want to play music. So that's what I try and concentrate on is the music, and not so much giving them any big career advice.
Yeah. Do you have a certain routine yourself in terms of improvisation or keeping your chops up on the piano?
Not really. Mostly it's just playing with other people, doing mm-hmm. gigs. One of the projects that I'm really enjoying right now, I bought during the pandemic, I bought a Hammond SK2, which is a dual manual organ. And I have a trio called the Vista Organ Trio with Scott Latham on drums and Alex Moxon on guitar, and I'm really enjoying that right now. So, I started talking and I forgot your question.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that organ, actually. I was curious about your routine in terms of practicing.
That's what I was going to say. Mostly it has to do with getting together with people and playing, doing gigs or doing rehearsals or, you know, jam sessions. I probably do more of that than actually sitting at the piano figuring out, you know, how to improvise better. I should probably do more of that. But it mostly comes down to playing with other people.
Yeah. And as a composer, a lot of my guests are improvisers and composers, so I'm always curious how that intersects for people.
Right. Well, I find composition a very insular thing. I can't write with other people. I know some people do that, but I have to really, you know, when I write something, it takes a long time, and I come back to it, you know, I sleep on it, come back to it, edit it, usually take out a whole lot of notes that shouldn't be there or are unnecessary. And then I'm constantly editing, you know, I'm always changing harmonies and melody notes and that type of thing, adding sections. I find that, you know, playing music is a very social thing for me, and writing is very much insular.
Yeah. Do you have any other creative pursuits you do for fun that are
creative? Well, I'm a cyclist. I love to I cycle just about every day. I try and always get in at least 20 kilometers every day, so I really enjoy that. And I like cross-country skiing and skiing in the winter. But as far as creative, I'm not a, my wife is an artist. She's a visual artist. She paints, and I have no talent for that whatsoever. I've made some feeble attempts, and that's not what I'm good at. So really, I've always, like I said before, I've always been kind of on this music track, and I don't think about a lot of other things.
So I guess the cycling, I was curious, because you always seem fit and healthy, actually, because, you know, the late hours and the early mornings taking the train and all that, it takes a toll, and, you know, can be hard to...
Well, you know, the best thing for our health as musicians who were working clubs was when they banned smoking.
Yeah.
I was never a smoker. I always hated cigarette smoke. Hated coming home and having to, you know, put my clothes in another room because they smelled like smoke.
Yeah.
And that was absolutely the healthiest thing that could have happened for musicians like myself.
Well, would you like to leave us with one last tune before we close out this conversation?
What could I do? Is there anything that you would like to hear? Do you have a request?
Actually,
I put you on the spot now, didn't I?
Yeah, you know what? There's a song that was played at our wedding, You'd Be Nice to Come Home To, which is a great classic.
Ah, yeah.
Do you know that one?
I do. I don't know if I know it well enough.
Then,
And that's written by... Who wrote that one? Do you remember?
I don't know. I know Mark arranged it for Brass Quartet, actually.
Right.
But, you know...
Yeah, I sort of know it, but not well enough to play it on the spot right now.
Well, you know, like how about like a blues tune, you know?
Okay.
Like different sure. style.
Sure, I'll play a blues for you. Actually, I just thought of something. I'll play a blues that I wrote, and this is if people who are listening to this live in Ottawa, they'll understand the title. It's called "Take the O Train." And it has sort of some of the elements of the, it hasn't been a smooth ride, you know, the train breaking down and so on. So, yeah, this is a blues with a bridge, actually. It's you know, the bridge is typically 12 bars. Mm-hmm. It's an 11-bar blues with a bridge. So it's a little bit outside of the regular blues. Take the O Train.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, it's really great getting to know you better today, and I'm sure my audience is going to so appreciate all your music as well.
Oh, well, I really enjoyed it, Leah. Thank you for asking me. I appreciate it very much. It's interesting to actually have somebody ask you to talk about yourself.
Yeah, it's different.
It is. Yeah.
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 Okay.
So thanks very much. I really enjoyed it. It's great talking to you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode, and you should check out some of my other interviews with jazz musicians, including Kelly Lee Evans, Roddy Elias, Eva Slongo, Diane Nalini, and Tracy Silverman. Please tell your friends about these episodes and sign up for my podcast newsletter to find out about upcoming artists and more, all linked at my podcast website, leahroseman.com, which is in the description of this episode.